Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Once again, contravening all that is traditional, just one guest today. Aziz Rana, the masterful critic of the U.S. Constitution, on how the political system crafted by that document and the reverence with which it's been regarded have not only given us Trump, but also have constricted our ability to fight him. Watching Trump and the diffuse attempts to resist his lunge towards serious authoritarianism made me think of Aziz Rana's critique of the Constitution, a document that has achieved the status of near-sacred text in American political life despite its anti-democratic thrust. Madison and the other founders were quite explicit in the Federalist Papers about devising a governing structure that would incorporate elements of democracy, but all within a system that constrained popular power in the name of preventing mob rule. Thus, the Electoral College and the abomination that is the Senate. Yet this document is venerated to a degree with few parallels elsewhere in the world. The Mormon Church officially believes it to be divinely inspired, a belief shared by 37% of white evangelicals and 18% of the overall U.S. population. The framers of the Constitution also aimed, as Aziz will tell us, to prevent the presidency from turning into a monarchical office, but Trump is doing his best to overcome those limits. The groundwork for his assertion of dictatorial power was laid by decades of expanding executive reach. Of course, to say that is not to deny that Trump is a serious turn for the worse, but these things don't come out of nowhere. How did this constitutional system and the reverence for it lead us to this miserable place? There is just no one better placed to explore that question than Aziz Rana. Last year, Aziz, a professor of law at Boston College, published The Constitutional Bind, How Americans Came to Idolize a Document That Fails Them, from the University of Chicago Press. Here's Aziz Rana. We talked about the constitutional order in some detail in our interview last May, and I do want to revisit that to some degree. But first, let's start by talking about how the veneration of the Constitution led to a political paralysis in the face of Trump. The constitutions and the courts will save us, but in fact, they helped produce him, right?
Absolutely. I mean, so there's this sense that the U.S. constitutional system, at least this is a common view, let's say at the end of the last century, the beginning of this one, is a near ideal distillation of representative democracy, combining checks and balances, an appropriate respect for majority rule, protections for rights. But in truth, the constitutional system itself is deeply out of step with global democratic practices. And that's because our system of representation is really framed around not the principle of one person, one vote, but instead around the idea of geography and especially the unit of the state as the principal defining instrument of representation. And it's the reason why, in many ways, the Constitution is centrally to blame for the rise of Trump, Trump's persistence as a political force even after he attempted to overthrow a democratically elected government, and his political return. So we have to just note, first of all, Trump lost the popular vote in 2016, in a sort of a functional democratic system, he would not have ended up as the president. And then, because of the way in which the Supreme Court is shaped, since it's organized through the president, elected through the Electoral College, and the Senate, which dramatically overrepresents small population areas, and so dramatically overrepresents the Republican Party, you have a situation where he was able to nominate and confirm to the Supreme Court three justices, despite again losing the popular vote, where Democrats have only been able to nominate and confirm five since 1968, even though they've won every popular vote when it comes to the presidency since 1988, except for twice. That would be in 2004, and then more recently in 2024. And then what that ended up meaning is that when he attempted to overthrow an election in 2020, it was incredibly difficult to hold him accountable. It was incredibly difficult to have him impeached. It was incredibly hard to have him criminally convicted. You also had a situation in which the court that had been shaped by Trump was able then to intervene in cases like Trump versus Colorado and Trump versus U.S. in order to make it hard to pursue criminal prosecutions, to create a blanket of immunity, which effectively was a blanket of impunity. And then, unlike other situations where you have politicians that attempt to overthrow elections and then they're barred from running in the future, our system also, through both court decisions and the general paralysis of the process, made it very hard to exclude him from future elections. And so it created a perfect storm where he comes back into office in a setting in which clearly he's motivated by personal animosities and a desire to go after political enemies and enrich political aides, and he's surrounded by loyalists who are ideologically extreme. And so in a way, this thought that the Constitution now can save us fails to take account of the fact that we're in this predicament because of the constitutional system, including because of the type of court shaped by the constitutional system. And even if there's a central need to think of the law as a source of constraint on rampant authoritarianism, ultimately, we'll only be able to get out of this predicament if there's genuine constitutional overhaul.
One of the prominent features of the Trump regime is expanding executive power in really appalling ways. But we've been watching the expansion of executive power for some time, right? And the constitutional system has allowed that.
Absolutely. So the version of constitutional politics that really emerges in the U.S. over the course of the 20th century is shaped pretty fundamentally by a powerful executive branch and a powerful presidency. And for two kind of distinct reasons that end up going together. The first is the problems with the constitutional order mean that there are these big debates in the first half of the century about, well, how is it that you have effective government if it's very difficult to use the mechanisms of the legislative process and if the courts are going to be interceding? And one approach was to think about formal changes to the Constitution. So actually reforming the constitutional system to make the amendment process easier, to address the issues of the Senate, to reform institutionally the Supreme Court, to create more pathways for constitutional change and also alter the dimensions of legislation, as well as, of course, move the country towards something that looks a lot more like one person, one vote. That's not the approach that was ultimately taken. The approach that was taken, you can think of presidents from Teddy Roosevelt and Wilson to FDR as playing a central role here, was instead to adapt a system of presidentialism on top of the U.S.'s very complex set of institutional arrangements. And so that presidential power, and especially a vision of presidential power in which presidents increasingly take more control over the leadership process when it comes to lawmaking, was a mechanism for grafting on what felt like more democratic means onto a system that really was limited in its capacity to reflect the interests of the people. And so this is the idea of a direct relationship between presidents and people. Now, there's a range of socialist, progressive, anti-war, civil libertarian reformers from the same period that were deeply wary about whether or not presidentialism was an adequate solution, precisely because of the capacity of presidents to claim through this direct relationship to the people a kind of usurpatory power that can lead in authoritarian direction. So that's something that had always been out there as a critique. And that worry really gets intensified in the mid-20th century in the context of the U.S.'s rise as a global hegemon against the backdrop of World War II and then especially the Cold War, where the U.S. essentially establishes a new peacetime national security infrastructure. The framework that we associate with the CIA that gets the Act in 49, the National Security Act in 47, an entire centralized infrastructure for pursuing various kinds of security practices overseas, but with its own real deleterious consequences at home. And what happens really starting in this mid-century period is that you have this powerful president that has a direct relationship to the people, and then you have the other branches, both Congress and the courts, that increasingly defer to presidential power in matters that are deemed national security or international. So what happens over there is something that's within the purview of the president. This is the idea of the imperial presidency that emerges and consolidates over time. That's like a background framework that's basically shared by both political parties.
Now, people have talked about the Roberts Court expanding executive power. I suppose that's true to some degree, but could you put that into context?
Yeah, so that there are two things. There is a bipartisan commitment. So this is a commitment that extends really across the ideological divides on the court to essentially defer to presidents in matters of national security and immigration. I mean, this is a common set of practices that the court engages in, and it gives a huge amount of discretion and leeway to the use of really intense forms of discretionary power. At the same time, there was a conservative, let's say, battle over the status of the administrative state, not in the national security context. The administrative state sort of covers a whole range of issues, issues that we think of as traditionally domestic, about the regulation of the economy, environment, etc., and then the infrastructure of the national security apparatus. For the stuff that folks think of as domestic, one of the legacies of the New Deal was something else, which was the establishment of independent agencies. In other words, that the country needed, you know, in the first half of the 20th century, not just more effective forms of democratic governance, but also a civil service, an administrative apparatus to address the complexities of the modern economy in a context in which the U.S., really, its administrative state of the 19th century was really one of, like, courts and parties. It was incredibly limited in various ways. And what New Dealers ended up doing was that they established through statute a variety of different agencies. And then they also ended up providing those agencies a great deal of independence to make determinations about how to address economic life. And the thought about this independence was it was supposed to be independence from various kinds of political actors, including presidents, to avoid situations in which presidents could assert extreme power over the agency in ways that, again, would target enemies, would engage in various types of self-enrichment. Now, this framework for the administrative state was itself something that was deeply contested among left and liberal actors, so that there were folks that were worried about the installation of a kind of managerial expertise. There were folks that were also concerned that even still, FDR was attempting to assert too much control, political control, over the nature of the administrative apparatus. But nonetheless, there was this thought that you had a framework that would ensure the regulation of the economy consistent with broad social welfareist ambitions, and that was independent from the power that a single strong political actor could assert. Now, over the course of the second half of the 20th century, conservatives, and especially as conservatives asserted more control over the courts, viewed the administrative state and its regulatory power as a direct threat, effectively, to business. And so they started developing a theory of the unitary executive. And the idea of the unitary executive was that presidents should have control over all of the internal judgments within the executive branch, and that the ability of Congress to establish agencies in the executive branch, you can think of things like the more recent Consumer Finance Protection Bureau or a whole range of other agencies, that they could establish agencies in the executive branch that they would still have some kind of independent power through. So the agencies would be separate from the power that the president could assert, that was a direct attack on presidential authority. And what the courts have been doing really over the last decades, and especially intensifying with the Roberts Court, is using this theory of the unitary executive to limit the capacity of Congress to establish sort of independent authority for agencies. And it's produced this interesting double feature of conservative jurisprudence, where conservative judges are both attacking the ability of the agencies to operate in ways that are not supervised through processes established by the courts, and then also saying that presidents can intercede to fire or reconstruct the agencies as they see fit. This had been like a small scale, small bore, kind of steady chipping away at the New Deal to like 1950s, 1960s infrastructure of the administrative state. And what Trump and company are doing right now is they're effectively taking that theory of a unitary executive, and they're using it to fundamentally recast the nature of presidential power by combining this incredibly expansive theory of executive authority that's most associated with national security power and national security discretion, and then saying it essentially applies everywhere in a way that fundamentally rewrites Article 2 of the Constitution, which is the part of the Constitution on executive authority, and that treats the president as practically supreme when it comes to lawmaking writ large.
I'm speaking with the legal scholar Aziz Rana, author of The Constitutional Bind.
Now, in all this, what you've been talking about, you talk a lot about the courts, about the presidency. Largely missing is Congress, which is supposedly the most democratic branch of government. What happened? Watching it behave under Trump, it's like it's ceding its own powers to this quasi-dictatorial figure. What happened to the legislative branch here?
This goes back to the reason why presidentialism emerges in the U.S. in the 20th century, which is the legislative branch has been weak and divided for large chunks of American history. And this is precisely because the framers, when they were thinking about threats as they understood it to rights and the fear of something like majority tyranny, primarily what folks like Madison and Hamilton had in mind was ordinary people that were not property owners. And they were worried about the institutions in which those folks can assert power. And that was essentially in a legislative branch. And so they saw the central threats to rights, really property rights, as coming from the mass of citizens using democratic means. And so the central institution for that expression, a legislature or a parliament, ended up being divided and compromised in all the ways that we've come to understand. So the fact that you have bicameralism, the vote structure, this kind of set of very intricate arrangements. And in the early part of the 20th century, presidentialism was sort of meant as a solve for that by essentially producing lawmaking in a separate area that would have a direct connection to the people and that perhaps overcome some of the problems of the legislative branch. And really, to the extent that the U.S. got landmark pieces of legislation during the New Deal period and then in the 1960s, when we were thinking about things like the Social Security Act or the Wagner Act that provides for collective bargaining, or in the 1960s, the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Act or the Medicare Act, it's not because the system worked, but because it was a strikingly unusual historical period. The 30s were a period in which you had so much organized collective labor power through unions and working class politics against the backdrop of the Great Depression, that even all of these checks and breaks on democratic decision making were overcome by the fact that FDR had access to huge rolling supermajorities. So if you have the support of effectively 75% to 80% of elected politicians, like he did in 1936 when he wins re-election. Three-quarters of the folks in Congress, both houses, are supportive of New Deal legislation, either Democrats or independents or Republican-aligned New Dealers, effectively. Then you can pass landmark legislation. Or in the 1960s, if you have a Cold War climate in which there's a sort of shared national elite, northern national elite sensibility that you have to address the problems of Jim Crow in order to win hearts and minds in the global South and confront successfully the Soviet Union, then you have a type of elite cultural and political consensus that reduces party polarization and is able to pass landmark bills. And really the problem since the 1960s in the U.S. is that you haven't had those two contingent features of the mid-20th century: strong organized labor power that can produce supermajorities, and then Cold War depolarization that can create mutual forbearance and agreement across the partisan divide. And instead, what you have is a legislative branch whose inherent weaknesses are intensified by the fact that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the breakdown of labor power, you have the steady and really now extreme defection of the right from what amounted to a mid-century compact, and a legislative branch that really doesn't express popular sentiment. That even when Democrats have control of Congress because of the nature of the Senate wildly overrepresents small population centers, rural states. Effectively, to have a majority of the Senate, Democrats need a supermajority of the population. And then to overcome subconstitutional rules like the filibuster, you effectively need a supermajority on top of the supermajority. And what that means is that the legislative branch is just not effective to actually pursue large-scale structural overhauls or landmark pieces of legislation that were the cornerstone of constitutional politics. In the U.S., one of the things that people don't appreciate is that the constitutional system, again, is perhaps the hardest in the world to formally amend. And so much of constitutional change takes place through successfully passing legislation and then the courts authorizing after the fact the legitimacy of that legislation. And now we're in a situation in which the president is unconstrained, the legislative branch can't actually pass landmark legislation, and the courts, because of the fact that they've been reconstructed by the Republican Party, wildly overrepresent one party as opposed to the public writ large, and so can't engage in its sort of classic 20th century function of legitimating constitutional change over time.
People, of course, are alarmed, rightly so, by Trump as a threat to democracy, but we should remember that the constitutional architecture was initially designed as a constraint on democracy, and under the previous constitutional order, we had horrors like Jim Crow and McCarthyism, so it was able to live with deeply undemocratic processes.
I think it's worth making two points. So the first is, this version of really unchecked executive power and presidentialism is itself wildly out of step with whatever you might think of as like the framers' vision of the Constitution. So they were deeply concerned about little d democratic energy from below, the kind of politics that had produced things like the Shays Rebellion or in the 1790s would lead to the Whiskey Rebellion. But they also viewed royalist power as a direct attack on the property rights of landholders as well, so that they were also concerned about monarchical authority. And that's the reason why in the writing of the 1787 text, the president doesn't have the power to dissolve parliament. The president doesn't have the power to declare war. That there are all of these limits and constraints on presidential authority. And what we've seen over the course of the 20th century is really the development of a presidential system that's also out of step with some idea of what the framers might have intended, and that certainly Trumpian presidential power is wildly out of step with the Republican sentiments that, even if they were elite and class-based, motivated the first and second generation of Anglo-American founders. But here's the problem. Because primarily they constructed a system that saw the threats to rights as coming from below and as about the property rights of either planters or enslavers, they created a framework that really deeply incentivized various forms of minority rule and especially the power of economic and racial elites. And this is a story that you can tell about the period before the Civil War, in which the constitutional system dramatically expanded the power of enslavers. That's the reason why you had the vast majority of presidents either being from states with slavery or supportive of slavery. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court gags on issues of slavery in Congress. It's the story of Reconstruction's violent defeat because of the types of incentive structures that really shaped local politics and gave state actors the ability to deform and compromise racial transformations. And we can tell this all the way through the present, where what the constitutional system has done in recent decades, as the right has effectively defected from a mid-century constitutional compact, is it's incentivized the worst instincts within conservative politics. It's created a situation in which the right can effectively control government without necessarily having a big broad tent coalition because of how the structure of the Senate and the courts and the Electoral College and gerrymandering in the House through the states, all of these function to give the right far more authority politically than they would if you're just operating through more majoritarian means. And what that's done is it's not only incentivized the use of these devices, but it's also intensified a critical component of right-wing politics, which is its xenophobia and ethno-nationalism. It's intensified the idea that a multiracial American society is an almost existential threat to the power of the right. And so that not only should the right use highly undemocratic means, once it has power, then you have you know, very strong sentiment on the American right that sees effectively undermining the profound cultural and social changes that have taken place in the country during the 20th century as an existential fight to return the country to a version that's more compatible with their own authority.
We're listening to an interview with Aziz Rana, professor of law at Boston College and author of The Constitutional Bind from the University of Chicago Press. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of the Western design by the Mekons from their new album, Horror. Here's a bit of background for my first question in part two of this interview with Aziz Rana, a definition of his concept creedal, as in Apostles' Creed, constitutionalism. This is from his book, The Constitutional Bind. I argue that this overarching myth of peoplehood, what I call creedal constitutionalism, combines commitment to the 1787 document with a conviction that the text manifested redemptive principles already existent at the country's founding. And here's an excerpt from our May 2024 conversation about the book that expands on the concept. As I was reading the book, I kept thinking of Bill Clinton's aphorism that what's wrong with America could be cured by what's right with America. It's just no way out of this perfect circle.
The framework that somebody like Clinton embodies is a romance about a Cold War national project that has a very particular way of thinking of the Constitution, that the Constitution is at the heart of that project, that the Constitution also goes hand in hand with this idea that the U.S. has been free and equal from the founding, that it's committed to anti-totalitarian civil liberties values, that those civil liberties are themselves tied to a commitment to property rights and to market capitalism, that all of that is also connected to a very restrained version of representative institutions with a powerful and insulated Supreme Court. And that together, it's a justification for American exceptionalism and why the U.S. should enjoy global primacy. And that way of thinking of the country really solidifies and consolidates in the mid-20th century. It's what I call the official story of the creedal constitution. And it's what both political parties really found themselves committed to. What we're seeing really over the last half century is not just the consolidation, but the steady exhaustion of that framework for addressing the really profound problems, both internationally and domestically, that the U.S. finds itself confronted by, and the way in which this way of thinking about American life has not only led to a status quo in which our institutions are pretty profoundly undemocratic, but it's also facilitated an approach to the world that ends up promoting forms of discretionary violence overseas and then undercuts our capacity to really think in genuinely democratic terms. We're at a moment where we can finally think outside those truisms of creed and constitution that have so shaped the basic presumptions of how politicians have spoken to us for decades.
That was a bit from my interview last May with Aziz Rana, and now on to part two of today's interview. We haven't really talked about your idea about creedal constitutionalism, but I would say that part of that creed is the idea that the system was more robust, that it could survive challenges of the sort that Trump represents. But obviously it's not.
One of the things that, let's say, I grew up with in the U.S. was a specific way of talking about the Constitution, which is, this is the idea that, you know, folks associate with the Federalist Papers, that the beauty of the intricate system was that it didn't require a society of angels for representative institutions to work. The thought was like power counteracts power, and so even if individuals are self-interested or don't have the interests of the society in mind, that the system as a whole would be able to function. And I think actually what this last decade and really the story of Trump's rise and the fact that he was not in any meaningful way held accountable for the one thing you need to be held accountable for in a democratic society, which is attempting to overthrow democracy, and his return and his actions now. What it speaks to is that to the extent that the system seemed to function in the mid to late 20th century, it really was not because of the devices. Actually, probably the institution required not a limited amount of social cohesion, but an extraordinary amount of social cohesion among political elites. And that's the thing that made it feel like the country could be able to address various flaws. And what I mean by this is that in those years, from the 30s to the 1960s, the combination of labor power in the context of the New Deal, those domestic developments, and then World War II and the Cold War, and that those set of international forces, that created a kind of perfect constellation of factors that built within political elites a willingness to pursue various types of economic, political, racial compromises that actually implemented the social policies that we associate with the American century writ large, and then also established a set of norms or practices around how politicians operate. And that once the conditions that produced those arrangements receded, so you have the collapse of the labor union and of working class politics through economic changes, the turn to neoliberalism, all that stuff starting with the 1970s. And then once you have the collapse of the Soviet Union and really the full on defection by the right from the mid-century compact, you just didn't have any of the cultural prerequisites that were necessary for the system to work. And one way to just think about this, you know, in a really kind of clear way that's dramatized anecdotally, is just think about somebody like how Obama and how Trump have operated in their post-presidency. Now, I have lots of problems with Obama. I wouldn't want Obama to necessarily be the leader of the opposition right now. But really, in any other representative democracy around the world, Obama probably would be the leader of the opposition. He's like the most charismatic politician associated with the political party that is out of power. But in the U.S., for a variety of reasons, including this mid-century compact, there was a set of assumptions about how ex-presidents behave. They essentially leave the political stage, and they're not supposed to be involved in political decision-making. And so even though he shows up occasionally basically to make it harder for the Bernie Sanders wing of the party to assert any kind of meaningful influence, and he'll give a speech every 4 years saying that democracy is on the ballot, he's essentially been not present. Meanwhile, Trump, who violates all of the strictures of how mid-century American politics had operated, just because he lost an election, that doesn't mean he's going to cede the political stage. He's operating like a person that is the head of a party formation, where the Democrats, and this is not just Obama, they treat the party as almost exclusively a vehicle for individuals to raise funds and get elected, rather than as a coherent political formation that has to contest culturally and politically for power, whether or not they win elections.
American political parties have historically been odd in the international context. They're not tightly disciplined. They don't really necessarily have a coherent ideology or agenda. Under Trump, the Republican Party has become that, very tightly organized with a very clear set of agendas, and something that, you know, if you depart from orthodoxy, you get excommunicated by Trump and his money bags. It's a transformation of the American party system.
And I actually think that's probably the thing that makes Trump perhaps most politically distinctive, at least over the long, you know, broadly speaking, 20th century in American life, which is we have not had a political figure, including FDR, that's able to assert this kind of discipline over his own party. FDR, quite famously, or rather infamously, failed in his effort to control Southern Democrats in 36 and then especially in 1938. And, you know, that failure for a variety of different reasons, including his own limitations in aggressively going after Jim Crow and issues of racism, but also just the limitations of American party politics, ended up having really disastrous effects for working class and, broadly speaking, left liberal labor politics in the country in the mid-20th century. But Trump is quite unusual in the fact that he can't seem to get a Republican necessarily elected, but he can clearly target Republicans within the context of the primary setting because of the control that he has over his base and essentially get folks cast outside of the tent. And it's producing, I think, both a clear strength for Trumpist politics and a profound and latent weakness. So the clear strength is that it's created this situation right now where Trump is surrounded by loyalists. He's not making all of these decisions, but he's essentially deferring to the ideological extremist that is most loyal to him in giving them their own fiefdom to pursue truly cruel and reprehensible policies in a way that is unchecked by any kind of internal party constraint that would typically be exercised based on concerns about electoralism. Like, what will this mean for the party in 2026 or in 2028? And so you're seeing a willingness to push far beyond what other Republicans typically have been willing to do because they're more focused on the traditional mechanisms of the elected party. The elected party and its classic leadership is a very minor player right now. At the same time, I think it's also part of why there's this inherent sort of instability in the Trumpist politics. One of the reasons why they're pursuing things so aggressively through the executive branch is that they too don't have the mass majority support to authorize and reauthorize these actions legislatively or at the ballot box. And Republicans have decided advantages to pass things legislatively because of the structure of state-based representation, which makes it easier for them to wield a majority in the Senate, for instance. And it also is why, at the end of the day, the Trump base is large enough to be incredibly destructive, to essentially collapse the mid-century framework of American constitutionalism. But so long as there are competitive elections, it is just simply put not large enough to be able to authorize something fundamentally new. And that's even before you get to the fact that the extremism of the folks around Trump is also matched by their pretty clear incompetence, which is even playing out, frankly, in the exchanges that Trump and company are now having with a Trump-nominated and confirmed Supreme Court.
I'm speaking with the legal scholar Aziz Rana, author of The Constitutional Bind. Speaking of courts, there's a lot of anxiety that Trump either already has or is about to defy court orders. First of all, what do you make of it? Has he defied court orders? And what would we make of the politics of him doing so?
There's this conversation about, is Trump a stress test for the Constitution? Is he initiating a constitutional crisis? I think that that honestly undersells what we're seeing. We're seeing an effort effectively through unilateral executive power asserted by a small group of Trump loyalists and ideological extremists again, to essentially tear down all of the foundational elements of mid-20th century American constitutionalism, to fundamentally uproot racial liberalism, to fundamentally go against ideas of civil libertarian protection for speech. You know, again, part of racial liberalism might include the idea, we can talk about its limitations as an actually historically accurate phrase, the idea of the country as a nation of immigrants and of immigrant inclusion. You can also include the effort to sort of tear down New Deal regulatory frameworks, notions of independent agencies, and then certainly the kind of classic powers that the courts have ended up developing. To me, the thing that is most troubling about the attack on the courts isn't necessarily that, oh my gosh, the court should be the final decision makers. I mean, the story of American constitutionalism is precisely one in which the courts have in various ways exercised profoundly undemocratic power and have been a co-participant in bringing the country to this particular stage. So the idea that a Roberts court, where a third are nominated by Trump, and frankly, the two most Trumpist figures on the court, Alito and Thomas, are not even Trump appointees, will somehow save the country, I think is kind of an absurdity. but it is absolutely an indicator of profound authoritarian threat, because what it speaks to is that Trump and the people around Trump are operating in a way that asserts absolute impunity for extreme forms of violence, forms of violence that in functioning democracies would be criminally prosecuted. For instance, the sending without any process of individuals to prisons overseas, the detention, again, without any process based purely on op-eds of political protesters. I mean, these are dangerous, dangerous assaults, and that's not even including the forms of continual self-enrichment that we're also seeing in terms of the ways in which Trump and those around Trump are operating with respect to an entire billionaire class. And that if you do not have a system in which those with power are constrained in their capacity to exercise violence, if you have a system which instead allows those with power to operate with absolute impunity, that is a direct attack on any count of democracy, socialist, liberal, any account of democratic politics requires some little c bedrock commitments to constitutionalism that's meant to assert control over extreme forms of presidential power. And that's the reason why I think that litigation right now from all of the various sites of civil society, from workers in the agencies, from the universities, from civil rights and civil liberties organizations, absolutely essential. At the same time, though, I think we have to be really clear-eyed about what we're seeing in the courts. What we're seeing specifically in the courts is a series of complex dynamics. The first is that the district courts and the lower courts tend to lean more democratic because majority of those judges have been appointed by democratic presidents, have been nominated by democratic presidents. The higher you get in the federal court system, to the circuit courts and then to the Supreme Court, the more Republican it becomes, and then at the apex of the Supreme Court, the more truly Trumpist it becomes. And increasingly now what we're seeing is a kind of internal fight within the Republican Party conservative legal establishment. What the Roberts Court was attempting to do initially was, in a sense, play ball with Trump the way that conservative judges have typically validated right-wing political practices. So you can see this in some of these earlier opinions, avoiding substantive decisions on the merits that say Trump's actions are either right or wrong, but giving Trump a huge amount of procedural leeway to pursue these policies. So take, for instance, using the Alien Enemies Act to claim that we're, you know, under some kind of war threat from gangs out of Venezuela to engage in mass deportations. What the ACLU and various civil liberties organizations and immigrant rights groups have wanted was for the courts, and this is what had happened at the district level, but for the courts to just issue a blanket injunction effectively saying that as a class that Trump and company can't use this authority to just blanketly deport people. The Supreme Court comes in and basically says no. That what you have to have instead is individualized process so that each person that might find themselves deported has some opportunity before a court to be able to contest their deportation. Now, if you're somebody that's interested in broadly protecting civil liberties, this is kind of disastrous because individuals won't necessarily know if they're going to be subject to deportation. Many of the people that are non-citizens that might face this won't necessarily have ready access to lawyers so that they can contest it. And the court where Trump is moving people to, the courts are some of the most conservative courts so that they're in places. This is the reason why we're talking about Louisiana or Texas. They're in places where you have conservative judges that will be listening to those initial hearings. So effectively, what the Roberts Court wanted to do was to be able to, without saying Trump is right on the merits, give Trump all of this procedural leeway to maintain the fig leaf of due process but allow them to proceed with the practice. But here's the thing. The folks surrounding Trump, like a whole bunch of the lawyers in the DOJ have either left or been fired, are not the people that were surrounding Bush Jr. Where you can tell the story of the war on terror is precisely this back and forth between the courts and a Republican set of lawyers in government that were continually in conversation, where the Bush administration would push something to the wall, the courts would say, you know, offer this fig leaf of process. They would offer a fig leaf of process. Ultimately, the practices would end up proceeding in ways that were deeply discretionary and violent, but under a kind of frame of legalism. The folks around Trump today seem like they have very little patience for even playing this game. And so they're unwilling to essentially work, it seems like, at least at present, with Roberts and company in creating a fig leaf of process to pursue these practices. And it's now generating a kind of internal tension within the rights legal establishment, where you have some Republican appointed judges that are like, this kind of practice, just essentially sending people to prisons in El Salvador without any due process, kind of shocks our notion of liberty. And then you have other judges that are saying, actually, that there's a broad amount of discretion that's provided to presidents in the immigration context, or, you know, making very kind of technical procedural arguments why even minimal amounts of process are not required. And so that's essentially where we've reached with the courts. And in a way, it's a striking commentary on the unwillingness of the people around Trump to sort of play ball in the ways that typically we've seen in the past. We're in the process of sort of figuring out how this is going to play out.
So to bring us to a close, you end your piece in the Annual Left Review sidecar blog by talking about building a left counterculture over the longer term as a way of resisting this. It seems unlikely that we're going to be able to revise the Constitution significantly anytime soon. So how do we work around that? What kind of things do you have in mind of building up alternative structures?
So I think that this is a moment where, in some ways, I know that there's been a fair amount of despondency about the perceived lack of initial response to Trump right after the 2024 election by comparison with 2016. But I do think actually one of the things that's been noteworthy, and in some ways it's a function of, again, the extremism of the Trump response, is we've seen the emergence of power asserted at various kinds of intermediate sites, intermediate institutions that have the capacity to sort of organize collective power and push back against Trump. And so this is unions in the federal government, the American Association of University Professors in Higher Education. And I think what that highlights is that if the right in various ways is engaged in a culture war, that one of the central features of any kind of organized left politics is to create a cultural world in which left commitments are just organically experienced in people's neighborhoods, workplaces, and schools. And a key way to do that while at the same time contesting the extreme power and violence asserted by the Trump and the folks around Trump is to build all of these types of institutional sites. So this means intensive litigation at the universities, but also really focusing on the strength that both the AAUP and various unions can organize so as to assert forms of self-governance and worker power within the university setting. It means professional associations and the kind of power professional associations can wield. Trump might be immune, but it's not the case that the people around Trump are necessarily immune from either criminal prosecution, civil liability, and then especially the lawyers that are engaged in direct assaults on the rule of law, on legal practice. Even like I'm using rule of law as in the conservative notion of liberal legality, that there's state bar associations that can impose various kinds of ethical discipline. This is the type of stuff that really brought down Rudy Giuliani, for instance. And you could say the same thing about medical associations. And then we can play this out in lots of different settings, including within party formation, so that if you can't rely on the national party's apparatus, you can still create infrastructure among all of the progressive politicians that are now have been elected because of the power of the Working Families Party or even or DSA at state and local levels, and how they can be connected to progressive national politicians. That effectively what I mean is that this is a moment for aggressive litigation organizing and activism tied to institution building at this intermediate level. That's a mechanism for integrating people into a kind of left cultural world. In the 30s, the thing that did the most to produce supermajorities for FDR was the power of the labor union. We don't have the labor union in quite that way today, but we have a plethora of civil society institutions that can play this kind of functional role, and that can not only engage in a politics of resistance, but can hold in various ways figures around Trump to account, while at the same time building political energy and coalition for more transformative changes. And I should add, and this is maybe the thing that I'm most hopeful about, which is that if the Trump folks are kind of collapsing the remnants of the mid-century compact, that they're in a position where they can engage in destruction, but they can't engage in a rebuild. And it means that the power for something transformative ultimately lies with us and the kind of activity we can bring to bear at all of these different nodes.
That was Aziz Rana, a professor of law at Boston College and author of The Constitutional Bind, How Americans Came to Idolize a Document That Fails Them. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. As I was putting together this show, I learned of the death of David Thomas, the lead singer and leading light of the old punk or post-punk band Per Ubu. He died with MC5 playing on the radio, according to the band's Facebook page. Here's a bit of Nabby from their 1978 album, Dub Housing. Till next week, bye. Boy, that sounds well.